Hello, this is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live. Today's guest is Robin Katsaros, and we're going to talk about Parkinson's disease and various facets of it. And I'm just going to start with you and for the backstory here, because I want you to tell us where you met your husband and why you were there.
Okay. Well, people say you can't meet wonderful people in a bar, but we met in a bar, the British Bankers Club in Menlo Park.
And so that's just not walking into some dive.
No. I kind of strategically picked it, but actually it was because I thought it would be a really nice, quiet bar because I'd only been there during the day for lunch. As it turns out, now this was quite a while ago because I've been married 33 years.
Wow, I didn't know.
It was sort of a, we called them pickup places.
Okay, good.
So anyway, a friend of mine who I was in her wedding, she had just gotten married about 6 months before and she got a first argument with her husband and called me and wanted to commiserate. So I sort of picked a place halfway between because she lived in San Jose and I lived in San Mateo, and Menlo Park was halfway in between. So we met at a bar. And I knew that night, I went home to my roommates. I did. People say that doesn't happen, but it does happen. I came home that night and said to my roommates, I've met the man I'm going to marry.
Oh, I'm going to cry.
But now it took him a lot longer.
Okay. So who spoke first? How did you end up talking to each other?
Well, first of all, he's handsome. He asked to buy me a drink.
Oh, so he spoke. Oh.
So I suppose that means he did speak first, doesn't
it? Yes, it certainly does.
I remember the drink. I guess he did. Yeah.
That's nice. So he took the initiative.
He did take the initiative.
Okay.
Yes, he did.
Yes, I think that's nice when.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So you have had 33 years together.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about something that is so important for people to know about. And tell us about your husband and Parkinson's. And if you don't mind, just to educate us all a little more, those of us who may not know, how did he first know that there was a problem? How does this onset?
Well, that's a good question. And everybody's different. And in fact, often Parkinson's is considered the designer disease because everybody is different.
Oh.
Everybody's journey is different. Everybody displays different. So for my husband, I remember the day distinctly. He came in from working in our yard. We lived in Los Altos Hills at the time. And his right pinky finger was shaking. Tremoring.
Oh, goodness. Just all by itself?
All by itself.
And he noticed this or you saw it?
Well, I noticed it, and I said to him, what's going on with your finger? And he said, oh, that's nothing. I said, well, no, it probably is something. And he said, well, I have an appointment. And I said, with whom?
Oh, he had already made the appointment.
And he had already made an appointment with a neurologist. So
he didn't want to worry you is why he said?
Well, it was really a shock for me because this is a man that makes no appointments for himself. You know, no doctor's appointments, no dentist appointments, no nothing. So I knew something was going on.
How long ago was this?
This was in 2008.
Okay. Oh, so that's a while.
Yeah, so it was a while ago. And I said to him, well, I'd like to go to the appointment with you. And he said, oh, you don't really need to. And I said, no, I'd really like to, and I'm really glad I did because that was the day he was diagnosed.
Mm.
It was July 31st, 2008.
Okay. What was your initial reaction?
Well, I think both of us, I can really remember in my mind sitting in the doctor's office, and it's kind of like time stood still. I think we were both in shock because you're just not prepared for something like that. You're
talking about after the diagnosis was made.
Okay. Yes, yeah. So, and for most people, getting a diagnosis is often difficult because there is no clinical diagnosis. There's no test.
Is that right?
There's no blood test. There's no test per se. What it is a series of questions that the doctor asks you, the neurologist, and then they have you perform certain tasks. And then usually what will happen is they will put you on some type of medicine, and based on how you react to the medicine is the confirmation of the diagnosis.
Okay.
So there really isn't exactly a test for it like there is for cancer or diabetes or for whatever. So that's why for some people, even getting a diagnosis can take years.
Let me ask you something just so people can know what to look for, which is kind of always my goal in doing something like this. What is the next step when you got home? Then what?
Well, My husband and I have two different ways to approach things. He was sort of withdrawing, and mine was to get on the internet and get every single piece of information I could have.
Was that helpful to you?
It was. Okay. And what I ended up doing was I first got on the internet, and I found out when the next conference was. And there was a young onset Parkinson's disease conference going on in less than a week in Atlanta, Georgia. So I got us tickets and flew us to Atlanta and figured that was the best place to start, because unfortunately the doctor who gave us the diagnosis did not give us any information on it at all. Not a brochure, not a piece of paper.
And you would have liked that.
Well, yeah.
So do you want to say to people that ask your doctors for, what do you want to advise?
I think what I'd like to say is to doctors, when you're giving a diagnosis, you need to have something. You need to give the patient, before they walk out of the door, you need to give them something. You need to give them a website. You need to give them a resource.
And if the doctors don't, then you can be advising patients to say, please give me something, or the spouse. And we're going to get into that role in a minute.
Exactly.
Okay.
You don't want to leave there. We were devastated. We walked out of the door. We were like zombies. We both broke down crying. It was awful. It was just awful. We didn't know what to do. He didn't even give us the definition of it. So we really didn't, other than we both knew who Michael J. Fox was. Other than that, that's really was the extent of our knowledge. We knew no other people that were personal friends of ours that had had this experience. So it was devastating.
And when you went to the conference, you learned what? And who was there?
There was a lot of people. There was about 400 people. And it was you see what your journey could be like. It's you see people that are at the beginning of their journey. You see people who have had Parkinson's for many years. You see people that are on walkers. You see that there's hope. At that point, I personally got connected with an organization called PAN, which stands for Parkinson's Action Network, which this year in 2016, it was merged with the Michael J. Fox Foundation, but it was the unified voice of the Parkinson's community. So it was the organization that advocated at the federal level for research, funding, and things that had to do with people that were going through the Parkinson's journey.
You referred to, just a minute ago, you said people who had been living with it for a long time and people were, you know, just newly onset. So what we learn from this is people can live with a long time.
Yes.
With this for a long time.
Yes. And everybody's journey can be different. It can be a slow progressing. It can progress quickly. It really depends on what you have. There are varying what I would call permutations of Parkinson's.
I was going to ask you that. So if people have such different responses,
What are various
permutations?
Well, as an example, there's a condition called MSA, which stands for multiple systems atrophy, and it's one of the Parkinsonism diseases. Mm-hmm. And it's actually different from Parkinson's, although it's under the same umbrella. And quite often, you don't find out that you have that until several years down the road. And the reason why that is the case is because what usually happens when you're first diagnosed, you're put on medicine, and how the person that has the diagnosis responds can determine whether they're re-diagnosed with another illness based on how they respond or don't respond to the medicine.
So how did life change? I don't imagine life changes much when it's newly onset.
Well, the first year, as far as Parkinson's in denial, which is fairly common. He was working at the time. He had his own company.
May I ask what he did?
Yes, he was in. He had his own internet consulting company with three other gentlemen in Silicon Valley, and he was very concerned about his job and his company and keeping it going. And so it's frightening. And if you're still the good thing about going to the young onset Parkinson's disease conference is you hear about these kind of things.
And when you say young onset, it is something that affects young people more often?
Well, no, it actually affects, I think the average age is around 60.
Oh.
But that is changing in terms of they're finding a lot more younger people being diagnosed earlier. What we don't know is our doctors becoming better at diagnosing? Is there more prevalence of it? We're not really sure of the reason, which is really a kind of sort of segues to another thing that I'm very, very passionate about.
Please.
And in the state of California, we are trying to get, there is a bill before that has passed in the state legislature for a Parkinson's disease registry. and it was passed back in 2004, but there wasn't proper funding for
it. What does that mean?
What that does is that keeps track and finds out where people that have Parkinson's are located.
For chemical.
Yes. So uh-huh. we don't even know. We keep in the.
Now, wait, I just have a question. So is this something that the doctors do, or your patients have to sign up for it themselves and do it?
Well, right now there's nothing. That's what I was trying to get at. Okay. The bill was passed, but there was no money that funded the bill. So it's been languishing for the past 14 years, and most people don't even understand that we keep repeating that there's about 60,000 people that are diagnosed every year in the United States, but we don't even know that for a fact. We have no empirical data. So it's
know the effects of clusters. Of
right, exactly, exactly, exactly. So it's very hard to pinpoint. It's very hard to pinpoint what factors are contributing to the disease, and the way to do that is to gather data. And to gather data, it's expensive. Now, when this bill was passed, there was some private funding that was about a little over $1 million that was done, and four counties were studied in California. And it was determined that there were clusters, and one of the clusters is in the Fresno, Gilroy, the area where we raise a lot of our food and our vegetables. And so what they have determined is there is definitely a correlation between pesticides, herbicides, and what things are done to our food and to our water table. And so it's very, very important. It's vital that we get a handle on where these things are being done, where herbicides are being used.
And it would also be important to know how many more people are affected by this now than they were, say, in 1730.
Exactly.
Which we can't know.
Exactly. Yes. And one of the things that they have found out, when my husband and I were first married, my husband lost his sense of smell. And as diseases go, losing your sense of smell, it really wasn't a big deal, and we didn't think too much about it. But as it turns out, that now can often be, in about 80% of the time, a precursor to Parkinson's.
Oh,
but we didn't know that back then.
About that. So he mentioned to you one day that he had no sense of smell, or you noticed that he wasn't smelling something?
No, he noticed it, okay. And he brought it up at his yearly physical. Oh. And there's a name for it. I apologize.
That's
I don't
okay.
remember the name in the back of my mind. But it was a disease that, okay, so he could smell skunks and very, very, very strong smells, but most other smells he couldn't. So, I mean, you know, it wasn't that big of a deal. It wasn't life-threatening. It really didn't affect our lives. We just didn't pay attention to it.
But what an important piece of information.
Exactly.
In a bigger picture.
Exactly.
My goodness.
And now knowing what we know
right.
and what they've since found out, it is important.
So if somebody were to notice that about himself now,
mm-hmm.
would the next step, do you think, just make a doctor's appointment?
Absolutely.
And say, look for
Absolutely.
Parkinson's now?
Absolutely. Because what is happening, we don't have drugs that can change the course of the progression.
But okay, how does it work?
There is a lot of money and time being spent on that. And what we really definitely need, and what I am passionate about, is getting people into trials so that we can do research and conduct research so we can drill down to the details.
Okay, so you wanted to give a website, I think, so
yeah.
people could learn about it, and if they want, take part in, okay.
Right. So what I recommend to people is when you're first diagnosed, because that's what we were originally talking about,
mm-hmm.
it's important to know that there's a lot of resources out there and you're not alone. And I think for our first year, that was the most important thing. And the way to do that is to get to connected to other people that have the disease. Find your peeps, so to speak. Find the people that you can hang with. Now, for some people, a support group is great. For other people, it's not. It just depends. But the Michael J. Fox Foundation is a wonderful organization that has a multitude of resources, and you can find it by going to michaeljfox.org. And on that website, there is also something called the Fox Trial Finder. So if you go to the main website and you go under Get Involved,
mm-hmm.
you will see the Fox Trial Finder
link. Right.
And
click
it and sign up. And the great thing about it is it's not just for people with Parkinson's. And what I try to explain to people is usually when you tell your friends and your family you are diagnosed with a chronic, progressive, non-curable disease, most of them ask what they can do to help.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that everybody can do because we need what are called control subjects just as much as we need the people that have Parkinson's.
Oh, so people can volunteer.
So we need people that don't have Parkinson's
mm-hmm.
as control subjects just as much as we do the people that have Parkinson's. And the other thing is we need people at all stages of the disease. So when you're first diagnosed frequently, and for the first, I think for about the first year my husband was diagnosed, he was not on any medicine. That is a really, really excellent time to get involved in research because they need people that have had no medicine in their system. So they can see the difference and track the difference. So, and that website also has a multitude of resources in terms of being able to find the right person to treat you. As an example, a lot of my friends don't realize, or people that have Parkinson's, they usually are diagnosed either through their primary care physician or the primary care physician sends them to a neurologist. But there is something called a movement disorder specialist, and that is an advanced neurologist. And all that MDS, or movement disorder specialist, does every day is work with people that have movement disorders, mm-hmm. Parkinson's being one of them.
As a nerve
issue. Yes. And the reason why it's so important to see an MDS is because they have done studies, and your quality of life as a Parkinson's patient is absolutely changed for the better when you are being seen by a movement disorder specialist.
Okay, can you just stop here for a minute and talk about, because quality of life, I think people would like to know for their own selves and people they love and are living with who have Parkinson's. What was quality of life from the time of diagnosis until you could really see a difference?
Well,
how long was that? And then what was the change?
Well, originally, as I mentioned, we first noticed just a minor flickering or tremoring in his finger. And then it was the hand, and then it was the arm. And in terms of progression, again...
Over how long a period, though?
Again, everybody's different. But mm-hmm. for my husband, I would say the finger trembling was, maybe 4 or 5 months. The hand trembling tremoring was maybe a year and a half. So
when you it came after 4 or 5 months and lasted and stayed at that stage.
You can't really use this is for everybody because everybody's different. But for us, that's how it worked. And then and I think at that point he was put on medicine. And there was one medicine, and he's still on it now, that they are targeting for people to slow the progression. So again, you mentioned a moment ago, well, if you have lost your sense of smell, so should you go to the doctor? Although we don't have a cure, there are a few medicines mm-hmm. they're coming up with that they believe may slow the progression. And so there is something you can do that you can start on fairly early where there are no side effects to that particular medicine, but they may, in fact, slow the progression of the disease.
So he's been living with this now for like 8 years, right?
Yeah, 8 years.
And life has obviously changed in some ways.
Yeah, it definitely has. You first notice usually the physical symptoms. And most people are familiar with Michael J. Fox, and they know the movement, and they associate Parkinson's with that.
But then there's the person's spirit.
There's their spirit. There's first of all, there's the depression that comes with it, which of course you would be depressed if you were, you may in fact have depression just because of the diagnosis, but it's an actual symptom of the disease itself.
Oh,
so it's
good
an actual. Yeah, it's and the reason why you Parkinson's is a you have a your dopamine cells have been killed, and so by the time you're diagnosed, about 80% of those cells have already been died off. So there's a multitude. There's tremors. There is your sense of balance is interrupted. Your rigidity in terms of your stiffness of your limbs can mm-hmm. change. There are also dementia issues that come into play as you progress, executive reasoning. So all these things come into play.
And has he noticed this in himself?
Yes, uh-huh. yes, we have seen
and
those.
Then there's you. There's your husband, and now there's you.
Yeah.
And what about you in this?
Well,
I mean, you must have had to learn some real new skills.
Yeah.
Emotionally.
I think the hardest thing, at the first year, my husband didn't want to talk to anybody, and we weren't allowed to talk about it. So the first year...
You mean like even around the dinner table and among
yourselves?
Right.
We told my husband's brother, and we told our two children. And for the first year, those were the only people we talked to.
And how did your children respond to that?
They were upset. They cried. And they wanted to know what they could do. And at the time, we really didn't know very much. So they, of course, have stepped up to the plate, and they're great resources now. But
how old were they?
When they were diagnosed, my youngest was still in high school, and mm-hmm. my oldest had just gone away to college.
Okay.
So, or had just finished college. Let's see. Yeah, he was had just finished college. So,
we get an idea of how, yes, they weren't little and they weren't totally grown men.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
What did you have to learn to do most of all?
Well,
I know patience is a hard thing to learn.
Well,
in general, I'm asking.
No, it's true. I laugh because for my friends who know me really well, patience is like my worst. I don't have a lot of it. And if there's anything I wish I had more of, that I pray every morning, I need patience because this care partner role is difficult, and it can be difficult. And one of the things that happens is my partner, my husband, moves much, much slower. And I look at him and I see the man I married, and sometimes I forget that he still has this disease and that there's
your expectations are based on what
he used to be.
He used to be, yes.
And it's not what he is.
Yes.
And I have to continually learn patience. So
does it help to know that it is absolutely not his fault?
It does. It does. But sometimes you just get tired. Sometimes you just get tired of it.
Yeah,
sometimes
yeah.
you say, I don't want this. And then I say, I can't say that because neither does he. And he didn't choose it. And I didn't choose it. And nobody chooses it.
And you love him.
And I love him regardless. And, you know, the people that tell you they would choose to have this disease, I don't know where they come from. But this is nothing my husband or I would have chosen.
When you say that, you have spoken to people who have...
Well, they think that it's a blessing, and I think...
Oh, you hear that sometimes from people who have... So what do they mean?
I think what they mean is... how I take it is, I don't think the disease is a blessing because it is not something we would choose, and I would not wish this on anybody. I think what you have to do is you have to see... There has to be some good that comes out of it, because if you don't see the good... You'll only dwell on the bad, and you certainly don't want to do that.
Right.
So the good thing is I've met a community of people that I adore, I respect, that I love, that I wouldn't have had before.
Mm-hmm.
So, and for that, I am forever grateful. I have a community of people that I rely on. And one of the things I did is I started a support group in my town, in Los Altos Hills. There was no support group just for caregivers.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, or care partners, and we have our own issues. There were definitely support groups for people that have the disease.
Yes.
But care partners, we have our own issues. And sometimes it's good to get together because you just want to complain.
Well, I think that's a huge issue in
exactly.
life. No, I mean,
yeah.
just I'm saying that we focus on people who have an illness.
Right.
And the reality of the people they're surrounded by has a direct effect on their illness.
Right.
And how they do. I'm quite sure of this.
Yeah. And nobody really gets it like the people who are going through it.
Right.
And I think that people have well-meaning ideas, but some questions that I've got that I will that I'm just going to say them so people can
do
understand
it,
that you know, people say how is John doing, and I'll say fine, and I'll maybe say something that happened, and they'll say, well, he looks fine, he really looks fine, he seems to be doing okay. With the intention, I think that they mean that they're happy he's doing well, but in the way that it's couched and in the way it's said, it's almost like sort of shake yourself out of it and get over it.
Oh.
And it doesn't work that way. And
uh-huh.
sometimes you just want to talk about it,
mm-hmm.
and you don't want people mm-hmm. to judge, and you don't want people...
Well, people can be frightened.
Yeah.
You know, there is that there, but for the grace of God go I.
Right.
That we can't help.
Right.
Because you know how frail these balances are in life.
Right.
So I'm wondering if that isn't a way of saying he doesn't really have anything wrong and I won't either.
Right, right. And I think that's part of it.
Scary.
I think that's part of it because, you know, it's nothing you plan and
right.
it's nothing you have control over.
Right.
And you do learn that there's a lot of things you don't have control over.
What would
over.
You like people to say?
I think what I would like people to say is, how's it going? And how are you doing today? As opposed to how are you doing? And then I know that what I do now when I ask people, I will say, how are you doing today? And then I just sit back and I listen. And I just let them talk because I find that that's really what they want to do.
Yes. Yes. You or
know?
Not.
Or not.
Right.
Or what I usually say is, how are you doing? How are you doing today? Do you feel okay talking about it?
Oh, that's very nice.
Because not everybody does.
Right.
Sometimes they want to be with their friends and they just want to not think about it.
Right. Now, what about your own being with your friends and social life? And are you still doing things? And
I
know you were traveling because you had something in France.
Yes. We used to own an apartment in Paris. And the idea when we bought it many years ago was that was the place that we would have retired a couple months out of the year. But after my husband's diagnosis, which happened after we, about 5 years after we had bought the place, I realized that that was probably not going to be in the cards for us because traveling is more difficult for people that have Parkinson's.
Traveling is more difficult
for everybody who don't. But when you have an illness that makes you move slower and it's hard to sit for long periods of time.
On an airplane.
Sure. So I realized that wasn't part of our journey, and we sold our place. But one thing that did happen last year that I'd like to share with everybody is my husband had what is called DBS, which stands for deep brain stimulation surgery. And we had this at UCSF.
I remember that. That's kind of when we met. Yes, go ahead. So describe that.
And it is a surgery where they it is for people that you have to apply and make sure that you're a candidate for the surgery. So not everybody that has Parkinson's can have this surgery.
What does it do?
What is done is stimulators are implanted inside your body, and two holes are drilled inside your brain, and there are electrodes that are threaded into your brain and then are connected to these stimulators. It's sort of like a pacemaker is to your heart. It's a pacemaker for your brain. And
I know we all got to follow on Facebook his progress and cheer on.
It was very frightening and it was very scary, but it was he did wonderfully well. We call him John 2.0. He's the new John. And his tremors are completely controlled. His balance is better. He's gone back to driving. He doesn't like to drive, but he is able to now drive because he's not shaking so much. He's not shaking at all.
This is a miracle.
It really is. It's
I'm so glad this isn't television because my mouth is just open.
Yeah. Well, we were very, very surprised. I mean, we were lucky. We had a wonderful surgical team. And I will say that we did look at three different surgeons across the country.
So is this something that patients should be asking their doctors about?
Well, yeah. If you're at the point where the reason why we got to the point where we wanted to have the DPS is because at a certain point, what happens with the medicines is because the disease is progressing, at a certain point you have to increase the dosage
and continue. Dose
at some point the side effects from an increase in the dosage are worse than the actual Parkinson's. So at a certain point in time, DBS is a good alternative. And it used to be the thinking was that DBS was sort of an alternative for much farther down the road, but they're finding by doing it earlier,
farther down the road in the progression,
in the journey of your Parkinson's, and they're finding now that they're opting to do it earlier as opposed to later. And for my husband, it's just wonderful. And so we've made a concerted effort after the surgery. We took about 3 months to get his stimulator adjusted at the right level, and we've made a concerted effort to get out and travel, so that there is nothing that we haven't done that we wanted to do.
Oh, my goodness. That is so – I'm going to cry.
Yeah.
Oh, that is so wonderful.
Yeah.
I had no idea about this. I didn't know what that meant,
surgery. Yeah.
Well, this is a really good time for me to get to ask one of my favorite questions is, who gets your love letter today? And as I'm asking it, I can see like six people that I would want to write to. And by the way, you don't have to choose one because – you're an expressive person. You could sit down and write a couple of them. Okay. So while you're... this is such a good time for tears because I think there are probably many people who
I think
like
there
to,
would be two people.
What?
One would be my husband.
Yes.
Actually, three. One would be my kids.
Yes.
And the third would be my group of friends. I've decided what's going to be on my headstone is... She couldn't live without her family, and she couldn't live without her friends. And my friends have sustained me, and my children have held me up when I needed it. And
there are your love letters. I mean, if you were to sit down and write, you have two sons, is that right?
Yes, Christopher and Matthew.
Separately, one to Christopher, one to Matthew. Yeah.
Right. And what their support means to us and to their father.
Yes. And to what kind of people they have shown themselves to be, all their good, strong qualities.
Right.
And you know something? Long after we're gone, they'll have this when they're 80 to look at it and remember what they were that you knew. And as far as what you write to your husband, your grandchildren will find it someday.
Well, and I think, honestly, Janet, one of the reasons why I wanted to do this is a love letter is something that it's the gift that keeps on giving.
You bet.
It's not like the internet. It's not like a text. It doesn't go away.
And it's your handwriting.
And it's in your handwriting. And you can see and hear the person when you're reading it.
Handwriting does that. It brings back a person. But I also wanted to say that, and I say it a lot because I'm always so touched by it, that when your grandchildren, should you have them, read this, or strangers do, or whoever finds this letter is going to be holding something that has felt the actual touch of your hand.
Well, may I share I don't know if we have time or not, but
yes,
when my mother passed away, you go through their things.
Yes.
And I found a letter that my grandfather had written to my mother, and I was named after my grandfather. And the letter, it was a series of letters. There's about six of them. And he wrote her poems, and he called her Honey Child, H-O-N-E-Y-C-H-I-L-E.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this little drawing, and it was a little bird.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a series of six letters. And in this letter, it talked about a ring that he gave her when she graduated from nursing school. That ring was the ring that my mother gave to me when I graduated from eighth grade. And I never knew about this story. She never told me. In fact, I'm thinking maybe she might have forgotten about it. And when I found those letters, he died before I was born, so I never knew him. But I had seen pictures of him. So here I have this letter, and I have the ring that is spoken of in this letter. And to this day, I think it is the most treasured thing that I have of my mother's and my grandfather's.
Yes.
And I hope that the love letters that I write to my children and my husband
will
evoke the same thing.
Yes. Yeah. And it's when you say the gift that keeps on giving, the power of them is really endless.
Right.
And look at this. Found letters opened doors you never knew were closed. You didn't even know they were. Oh, I'm so happy you told me that.
Yeah.
So when you talk about to your support group, how many friends are in this group?
Well, people come and go because, unfortunately, people get the disease, they die, and they move on. It started off with about 6-7 people, and it grew to about 20-22.
These are people who have Parkinson's.
My group that I created was for care partners.
Oh, so I'm talking about the partners. Oh, I see. So each one comes with a partner. Yes.
No. This is a group just for the partners.
Yes.
So the people that have Parkinson's, they go to their own group.
No, I understand that.
Oh,
so I can get my question answered about how many partners they are. The hint is how many people who have Parkinson's there are, right?
Oh, yes. Okay.
So you could over time, I'm so big on giving assignments.
Yes.
You could over time, once a month, just sit down and write a few lines to somebody in the group, to one of your partners individually, if you felt like it.
Actually, that's a really good idea.
So each one, because it's hard to write a group letter, because where does it go? Who keeps it?
Well, that's a good
point. Oh, you leave
point.
Such a trail of yourself.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
I hope you do it.
Plus, the love keeps on passing on.
That's right.
Yes,
and by the way, for grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and look at when you found the letter that your grandfather wrote, you're smiling so dearly because... How powerful that is to know that you come from a legacy of such love.
Right, right. And that's what you're passing down. Because
yes.
When people die, they never say, I wished I could do another deal, or I wished I had another house. It's always about the relationships and the love that you shared between your friends and your family.
It's the only thing that really matters.
That really, truly matters.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, thank you so much for doing this with me.
Thank you for having me.
I learned so much. Okay, we're going to just pass this around. Because there is a lot to learn, and that was—it's just such an emotionally generous thing.
I think I'd just like to close it with, you're not alone if you have this disease. Get involved. There is so much for people to do. We need all kinds of volunteers, whether it's helping another person, whether it's volunteering at a local support group, whether it's sharing your ideas with your partner, whether it's helping a friend.
Or being a healthy person in a trial.
Exactly.
Never even
or being a healthy
that.
Person
yes.
in a trial. Trial and research is vital to finding a cure and helping get this devastating disease
may
off the map.
May I ask how old... He is now? John?
My husband is 65.
Okay, and people do live a long time with this.
They do. We have people in our support group that their husbands have had it for over 25 years.
Okay, so that's an important, encouraging piece of information.
Absolutely.
Because
absolutely.
As much as things seem to have to change, we have to make changes anyway as we get older.
Right. I mean, there's people that have had it that have died relatively young, and then there's people that have had it for many, many years. Mm-hmm. So, and there is a lot of money and research being put into this disease. There is definitely hope. in terms of finding a cure, and in addition to not only just finding a cure, but finding ways to help our life be healthier and more livable while we have the disease.
And I like the word hope, because without that, you know,
there's nothing.
Okay. Thank you, darling. I wish you and John well forever.
Thank you
and
so much.
Again, I'm so grateful. Okay, well, for now, this is Janet Gallen saying goodbye, and we'll talk to you soon.